Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
Sunday the 26th of November, about under a month to Christmas, and looking forward to a much deserved break to decompress. How's your week been, Kev? You got over the travel and any bugs?
You've just traumatized me by saying it's a month to Christmas.
Well, it is.
Flip me. Unbelievable. Where did the year go?
Where did the year, exactly. And even in this awful market we're in, it's amazing how quickly this year has gone.
It's gone. Yeah. No, my week's been a bit up and downy because I wasn't feeling very good after coming back from Rwanda. I had a bit of a coughing fit and still chest's a bit sore. So yeah, hopefully I'm on the mend now. But yeah, it's been a week of lying low, to be honest. So yeah, that's been.
All right, let's have a look at some of the news this week. That's the news that's dominated. We've had Israel and Hamas reached a deal to exchange 50 hostages held in Gaza for a four-day pause in fighting, with 150 Palestinian women and teenagers to be released from Israeli jails. The deal, which involves the release of Israeli nationals or dual nationals, also increases humanitarian aid into Gaza. The pause will see a cessation of Israeli drone and aircraft activity in South Gaza, while Israeli troops and tanks remain in position without attacking or arresting anyone. This agreement allows for safe passage in Gaza and the entry of aid, fuel and gas via Egypt's Rafah crossing, although displaced people from the north cannot return home yet. The deal also involves the release of 150 Palestinian prisoners, mostly young men and women, by Israel. So hopefully a bit of let up in the fighting there, and giving them a chance, everybody, to get, you know, breathe and get aid in there, right?
Yeah, thank God is all I can say. Let's hope it continues, because I know in the wording of it, it can go on for longer than 4 days. Yeah. As more hostages are released. So let's hope that happens.
Hope it's the start of the end, as they say.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think Israel was expecting it, but I think they're going to have to come to the table and talk about a two-state solution now, and let's hope that's what actually happens.
Yeah, moving next on to the next news, obviously, the autumn statement by Chancellor Jeremy Hunt introduced several key measures, namely economic growth and public finances, and wage and employment side of things. The national living wage will increase from £10.42 to £11.44 per hour from April 2023. So benefits and pensions, we saw a little bit that universal credit will rise by 6.7% from April 2023. Housing allowance will also increase. National insurance, I mean, this was probably the one of the headline figures was they're going to cut the rate of national insurance from 12% to 10% from January, impacting about 27 million workers. And then there was also a business and infrastructure bill where the government will invest 500 million over 2 years in AI innovation centres. A new tax relief for research and development will merge existing schemes with a permanent full expensing scheme, allowing firms to write off costs on new machinery and equipment.
What do you make? They reduce employee. They've obviously reduced employee national insurance. Did they reduce the employee national insurance as well?
Yeah.
Or was it just employee?
I think it was 2% cut, wasn't it? So businesses are going to benefit from it as well as employees.
Okay. So, I mean, it is a bit of a pulling a rabbit out of a hat scenario, because, I mean, it does make a difference, but it'll be nominal what the difference will be. And longer term, with not increasing the different bands by inflation, is effectively really not going to mean very much in a year or two's time, as we continue with this 12,500 or whatever it is as the minimum that you can earn before you pay tax. So yeah, just a bit of juggling, to be honest. I mean, I think that's basically what's happened, isn't it? I mean, he doesn't have a huge amount of room to juggle, but he's juggled what he's juggled, and you know, I don't think anybody's going to particularly change their mind about Conservatives the best people to run the country or Labour. But I think you've got Hobson's choice now, to be honest with you. Do you want Labour or do you want Conservative? And that's normally what it comes down to, isn't it? It's Hobson's choice. Which one do you want? Do you want this bad one or do you want...
Politics has always been very much like the best of a bad bunch, hasn't it? It's always been that kind of choice, the lesser of two evils or lesser of three evils, you know, in that respect.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so we'll see. I don't think anything drastic happened anyway. So yeah.
Well, shall we welcome our guest this week? We're joined by Charles Archer, long-term FTSE AIM investor and freelance financial analyst, working with various platforms including IG Index. He goes by the Twitter X handle of @thatstocksguy. Welcome back, Charles. How's Tritz?
Oh, things are going very well. As I said to you just before we started the podcast, my living room window is being replaced, so the house is extremely cold. I'm extremely cold. If you hear any shivers in my voice, that's what it is. How are you? What have you been up to?
Yeah, all good. We're just, let's say, decompressing, reacclimatizing after our epic trip to Dublin and then on to Rwanda, which I'm sure you probably heard about and obviously saw. Indeed. Some Twitter photos of the, or so X photos posted of the gorilla and the monkeys, the golden monkeys, etc. So that was excellent. And obviously we visited Conroy as well, Conroy Gold, which I'm sure we'll come on to later. But do you want to just give us just one bit of news? Obviously, Kev and I have just discussed that at the opener. Was the autumn statement from Chancellor Jeremy Hunt. What do you make of that and the effect it may have on the common person?
That's really interesting. I just did a piece in the Financial Times for that this morning. So there's two ways to look at it. The first is the macroeconomic implications. So you have this situation where the government, the Conservative Party, wants you to think that fiscal policy has loosened. But if you look at the numbers from the Office for Budget Responsibility, they're saying that by 2028 to 2029, the proceeds of fiscal drag, so that's where your pay rises, put you into a higher tax bracket, will bring in an additional £44.6 billion by 2029. And this 2% national insurance cut alongside the other cuts will cost about £10 billion a year. So you're essentially robbing Peter to pay Paul. The tax burden is still going to be the same 37.7% by 2029 of UK GDP. And that hasn't changed since the March figures before the budget. So on a macro scale, nothing has changed at all. You're kind of just shuffling the figures around. Now, if you're talking about, you know, from a personal finance perspective, the median pay is about £35,000 a year. So if you're earning 35 grand right now, you'll be taking home roughly 28 grand in disposable income, and you'll be losing about 20.2% of your income tax and national insurance. If you get the 7.7% average pay increase, and again, all in my Financial Times article this morning, then you'll be getting £37,450 next year. And then with that national insurance cut, you'll be taking home just under 30 grand in disposable income. So you're about £2,000 a year better off. However, you have to take into account inflation of about 4.6%, increased housing costs. The wage growth is probably going to get stagnant again. And then because the income tax thresholds are frozen for the next few years, the only year where you're actually better off is the next calendar year, so 2024. And thereafter, you're worse off again, even with the national insurance cut. But you have this political situation, which is really, really fun, where you can have a headline that says the typical full-time employee's disposable income has risen by 7.3%. And you can have another headline saying that the tax burden has fallen by just 0.2 percentage points. And both of those are completely true. It just depends on your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You said that you're effectively, you know, the person earning the 35 should be roughly 2,000 better off. There was a think tank, I don't know if you know, you saw the report, the Resolution Foundation, who basically said that families will be approximately £1,900 poorer at the end of the current parliament compared to its start, despite obviously the introducing the tax cut. So it was interesting that their look at it and how they found a different number.
I think it really just, the problem with it is that it depends on whether you're talking in real terms, with inflation adjusted, or nominal terms, whether you take into account benefits, you know, cuts or additions, whether you're thinking about public spending, for example. So one of the minor things that people don't really tend to think about is council tax, right? So let's say that goes up by 5%, and that's from your after-tax income. And unless you are, you know, in a very dire situation, nobody really gets support on council tax unless they're earning virtually nothing. So you have the situation where, you know, I'll give you an example. I live in Exeter. I have a swimming membership, and that membership went up by, I think, £7.50 a month a couple of months ago, right? My council tax is going up by, I think, £300 this year. When I go into town and I park, that's gone up by a couple of pounds a day. And so you have this situation where all these kind of like little taxes, car insurance, which is mandatory and is therefore a tax as well, that's gone up. Obviously, mortgage and rental costs have gone up.
70 to 80% for the average motor.
Exactly. So you have the situation where the typical worker might be earning £2,000 more, But on top of typical inflation, I mean, one of the other problems is when we talk about inflation, we talk about consumer prices index inflation, which takes into account things like going on holiday abroad, for example, or buying a new car. If you're that medium worker on $35,000 a year, and you've got a couple of children to support, you're probably not going to be too stressed about, you know, whether you're going on a holiday to Rwanda. Okay, you're going to be thinking, can I afford my mortgage? So when you strip out those kind of like that kind of luxury spending, you know, and you're just saying, okay, housing costs, food costs, energy bills are going up by 5% again in January, nobody's actually better off. But again, it all just depends what headline you want to write. It really does. I mean, this is the point that I was trying to make in my piece, that yes, you know, you will have £2,000 a year more, that average earner, if they've got the average pay increase and they've got the national insurance cut. That is a fact.
Yeah, it makes sense.
But if your expenditure has gone up by more than that £2,000, which it almost certainly will, then you're going to be worse off. So, you know, I guess that's it. You know, it's what headline do you want? I could happily write an article while you...
The biggest thing that I think, or the biggest tax burden that was put on the whole economy, was the freezing of the tax-free limits, if you like, for 5 years. Yeah. This was massive, because...
Absolutely.
If you look at that increase by inflation, we would have been at least 15,000 to 16,000 as a tax-free threshold by the time the parliament was finished, you would have imagined anyway. And that £3,000 or so of tax-free income would have made a dramatic difference. You know, you would have been talking about £250 a month or more that would have been totally tax-free. This is massive. And everybody just sort of went, oh, well, it's just not going up. But actually, it's massive in terms of its impact.
It was just a stealth tax, really, wasn't it? They thought people had overlooked. But actually, if you do know what you're talking about, you see it and you think they've just dragged so many more people into that higher tax threshold, haven't they?
I think I'm trying to think of the words. When you have inflation at like 1 or 2%, you could have got away with it for a few years. When you have inflation at sort of double digits for about a year, then you can't. And I think what one of the really interesting things about this is that, like, a long-term aspiration of the government is to get people in their 50s and 60s who have retired early to continue working in the workforce. Now, if you take like just my personal situation, I won't give like all the details, but just generically, anything I earn between 50 and 60,000, I have corporation tax, dividend tax, high income child benefit charge, and student loans on top of that as well. So my tax burden is about 70-80% for that £10,000. Now, where you have the income tax freeze at sort of £50,000 roughly for that, you know, for higher rate taxpayers, you have the situation where if you have children, anything you earn over 50 grand, you put it into a pension, because alternatively, you're looking at like a 70 to 80% marginal rate. And therefore, what the government is doing is anyone who's doing well for themselves or earning a decent amount of money is building up a massive pension pot. And then by the time you get into your 50s, it's easier than ever to retire early because you're forced to save by government policy, which is absolute madness. The problem is that there are so many things, but where it's a high income child benefit charge or the 60% tax trap between 100 and 125,000 or child care or the VAT tax cliff, I think is the other one that really needs to be looked at. So if a company earns over 85,000 in income, then they have to start charging VAT. And that can be, you know, depending on the size of the company and the size of the clients, that can be really tricky. So for example, when I had to start implementing VAT on my own clients, almost all of them were fine. But a couple of the smaller startups weren't able to take that additional tax burden. And so I either had to face the choice of reducing my rates to accommodate for it, which I did for a couple of clients, or they just said, sorry, we've got to find someone else. So it's a real strangle on growth, especially smaller companies. But yeah, I mean, this is the problem. I think the whole tax system needs to be completely rewritten so that it's both fair and competitive. But I don't see this particular government or the next one doing anything about any of it. What do you guys think?
Yeah, no, agreed completely. Should we move on and talk some your list of? I noticed you put together a list of what you call the penny stock shortlist, the best growth shares of 2024, and there are some parameters there, and it's quite an interesting article because obviously you were also asking for submissions, which are quite light. But let's have a look at some of the parameters before we talk the list. So it must have a market cap under £10 million at the 1st of December. It must have a relatively active CEO. I chuckled at this one. I'm thinking of what active meaning they're doing swimming, they're going down Some of the people on this list have got, you know, CEOs that are in the 90s. So I'm not sure that a lot of them.
No, he's chairman.
No. I know you're having a laugh at me, but no, I mean just someone who's prepared to engage, you know, he's on video occasionally, who does an interview. And the reason for that is purely journalistic. If you have an RNS every 4 months, there's nothing to cover. I'm not going to be able to write anything or be, you know, it's not going to be particularly interesting.
Like a SPAC or something that sat there with nothing for a year, or even they just do the financials once. It's got to have active, they've got to be putting out news frequently. Yeah.
Yeah. And then on top of that, ideally you want a CEO where if you're an investor, you can send them an email with a query. And as long as it's not market sensitive, you might get an email back occasionally. You know, you want that kind of, like, for larger companies where you've got, you know, a massive market cap and you've got a lot of things going on, that's not particularly fair. But my perspective is that if you've got a market cap under 10 million, you kind of have to sweat a bit for your investors. You have to be able to say, we've got an investment case. You as an investor have a finite pot of money to invest. Here's why you should pick us over X, Y, and Z. I think that's really important.
And then the other one, it can't have an overly complicated finance base, which makes sense. It must be the stock most likely to see a multiple return regardless of risk and not have red flags. High risk is fine, lifestyle companies are not. So the general idea is that this growth stock will be at least double in value, hopefully more. In other words, it's likely to be a moonshot with a flagship asset that could deliver spectacular returns. As this is a growth stock, investors should approach it with risk money, with the understanding that while the possible returns may be spectacular, there is a good chance that they might lose it all. In other words, do not go all in. So should we start with BSF Enterprise?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, the whole idea around BSF is they've got cultivated meat, which is actually edible. You had directors ate the meat, that, you know, on video that they had made.
Yeah. Kev's tried it as well. Kev, talk about it.
Have you? That's cool. I didn't know that.
I ate the meat when we were down in, where was it we were at?
Well, it was at the Greenwich University, I believe.
Yeah, we had a pork fillet and a pork twizzle or whatever it was called. It tasted like pork. Like,
there we go. That's all you need.
It was sort of, you know, it had the bite, if you like, of meat, and flavor was pork. Simple as.
I mean, it's simple. You know, what more can you want? I mean, the most interesting question for me is whether the Vegan Society gives the company a stamp of approval, because this is a philosophical question, because is being vegan about not eating animal flesh, or is it about removing cruelty from the world? And obviously, there's all sorts of opinions about that. But the potential is really, really strong for BSF. And yes, it's been sold off a bit. And yes, a lot of investors
The last RNS, they also said that effectively they've got a good cash runway for the next, yeah. Like I said, 2 years, but it's probably more like 18 months now, because that was a few months ago. But it looks like they're in a good cash position. And it's not just the meat as you know it, the lacro meat, but they've also got the cornea, they've got the leather. And
medical application.
City Mix is the one that actually will generate the revenue, if you look at that as a media.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the one thing for me is that it appears to me that the process of making these products is quite expensive, and it's going to be because it's proprietary. Yep. So it's getting it down to be economically viable for the mass market, you know, regardless of what they're marketing to. And that's going to cost money. Now, at their current cash position, as you say, the next 18 months, I think we can pretty much guarantee they're fine for at least the next year and probably longer. Not investment advice, but, you know, you do the numbers, it's very easy to... But the problem is that to bring that down to economic viability means they have to spend more cash in a shorter period of time. So they need to get get a bank to give them a loan on favorable terms, or they need to get someone to get in partnership with them. And I think that second option is more likely.
I think it's inevitable that it's the second option. They're not going to be the producers of this meat. They're going to be the proprietor of the technology that allows it to happen, and they're also going to be the proprietor of the City Mix, which allows that the amount of input to be reduced by about 60 or 70%, I think. So that's what the City Mix does. It's almost like a bioreactor type thing that will allow them to have less of the source material that's required to make the meat. So I think that's the interesting part, in my view, is that yes, they need a partner, But those partners are then going to use the city mix, and the city mix is going to hopefully start to create revenue streams within the company, which will then allow them to expand the things. But if someone takes this on and produces, then every piece of meat they're going to produce, they're going to pay BSFA.
Yeah, a royalty fee, presumably.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that'll be something. For me, it's one of those companies where there's nothing really quite like it out there elsewhere. So
here's a question for you, Charles.
Yeah, hit me.
If this company was listed, I mean, I know they've got the OTCQB listing in the US, but if they were another DAC listing company, what valuation would this have?
This would probably have a much higher valuation, because in the US, they're primed to invest in risk assets. And while this is a risk asset, the growth potential is definitely there. Now, there's a reason why AIM companies tend to leave the UK and go to the US when they get to a specific valuation. I think, would their market cap be probably at least double what it is now? I'd say possibly. Then having said that, there are plenty of companies leave the UK for the US thinking their market capitalization will increase sharply. And then it turns out to have been a bad idea. So I think a lot of it is about how you market it to US investors. And what it is there's this idea that what we'll do is we'll it seems to be more common in like the life sciences or biotech sector. What we'll do is we'll just leave the UK market and go list in the US, and then our market cap will just explode. It doesn't just happen automatically. The ones where that works have very, very carefully planned out a sequence of events that makes that happen. But yeah, I think it's undervalued. But like many companies, are just undervalued in the UK just by listing in London.
Just make it clear that one is obviously a main market listing. But
main market, isn't it? Sorry, apologies.
No, it's fine. But it's the same principle. It's a nano cap, small cap, high risk company. So, okay, so I think we've done that one pretty well. We've covered it. Let's look at Aterion. And obviously, Kev and I were down in Rwanda last week, visiting the lithium mine HCK1, and we also saw their trading. What are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, sorry, I'm just pretending to be a gorilla there.
Oh, very good. I saw that wonderful photo of you. I'm glad you saw the family. But sorry for the slur, the pretty poor joke there. I think Aterion, obviously they've got really interesting assets. It's made the news this year for the joint venture with Rio Tinto. 2,750 hectares, you're in southern Rwanda. So it's a really prospective tenure. There might be $7.5 million invested by Rio Tinto to drill through those assets. And it's got the potential to be really lucrative. It is early stage, but I looked at that and I thought market cap £8.1 million, Rio Tinto possibly going for $7.5 million of investment. To me is a mismatch of valuations, and then you have the other assets as well. But I guess you guys were the ones who visited. You probably have a better insight than I do. So what would you say were your takeaways from the visit?
Well, we stood on regarding the lithium first, we stood on the hill. The Rio Tinto geologist pointed out the leached situations where the lithium would have been and where it's been weathered. And the idea is that lithium has found its way down into the bedrock, into the spodumene. And they're basically drilling for this spodumene. Now, what normally happens in these lithium things is they come out in clusters. Yeah. So in other words, you like get clusters of hills. And if you look around from the hill that we were on, HCK1, which we stood on, HCK2 is just across the valley. Again, looks prospective as well. And then there are any number of little hillocks and different things all around that area in terms of there being the possibility for being clusters of this lithium. Now, we also asked one of the guys, how much potential lithium could be in this hill. On a conservative basis, and they were saying 30 to 40 million tons was possible on this hill. Now, that would be the joint venture, in one hill, and there are 19 targets. Now, it could be absolutely washout, and there could be nothing, but I think from our meeting with Rio in the new office, they've moved into Rwanda, into a new country just for this asset. It says everything to me that they're very prospective that it's there, or they think it's there. So that would be the lithium. The way that Aterion is built is going to be almost like on a Glencore basis, where they're going to start trading the tin and the tantalum that exists within Rwanda on a large scale amongst artisanal miners. And that is now all ready to go. They're just waiting for the first offtake, which I think will happen within the next 6 to 8 weeks, touch wood. That happens, and the company is then self-fulfilling prophecy. It's funding itself, and that would be very interesting. And then I think the biggest upside opportunity is probably the copper and silver assets in Morocco, because basically they've got a whole hillside. They sent us photographs while we were there, actually, because the CEO was in Morocco. So they sent us photographs of the green weathered copper that was in the rocks at surface. And they basically believe that this is, I forget how many kilometers, but it's something like 20 kilometers of strike length of copper. Now, they don't fully expect that it's going to be 24 meters of solid copper, because that's not going to be the case. But
we'll be billionaires tomorrow.
Yeah, but you're going to have outcrops of copper the whole way along this 24 kilometers. And there's no doubt that they've got people sniffing around that as well and coming to see it. So, you know, I think Aterian is one of those ones where I really liked it because of the trading arm in it. Because the trading arm could mean that you won't actually get diluted in this company because they're going to fund themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, touch wood. I mean, the only way I think that this company will dilute itself is, one, it needs a bit more money to make sure the trading arm gets going. And two, that if they find something massive in Rwanda, because the other thing that's happened in Rwanda as well is that, and we said this on the podcast last week, a lot of the licenses have been taken away from people because of safety reasons and they didn't fulfill their obligations. So Aterian now is at the front of the queue to get some more of those licenses, and they include lithium licenses as well. So there is big potential then for them to increase what they can do, especially in Rwanda. So that's what I think.
I think the copper assets probably are being overlooked because you have that joint venture with Rio. But I'm trying to think of the words. One of the things that I try to do and try to specialize in is find companies which are a little bit oversold in the junior resource sector, where it's not going to be your main asset in your portfolio, but you buy some shares while they're cheap and while they're good value, you cut them away, you wait 5 years, you come back, and you've made a decent profit. Aterian fits the bill to me. I mean, when you've got a market cap of just 8.1 million and the assets that they have on the books, I think that's just, it's just a decent proposition. And that's why I thought, you know, you want to have a few growth stocks you want to look for. That's got to be one of the top hits for 2024. And by the end of 2024, is that market cap going to still be 8.1 million? I would imagine it would be higher, especially where we are in the cycle. Just in general, I think most junior resource sector companies that have a decent business case will be much higher in a year from now than where they are currently.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that we got the message while we were there is Rio aren't messing about. They're in country, first project, only project that they've got in country. You know, he mentioned 40 to 50,000 meters of drilling on this project next year.
A lot of drilling.
That is a serious amount of drilling.
Well, Rio Tinto is a major for a reason. They don't throw money around for a reason. And junior resource companies, I know dozens of junior resource companies who would love to have the same deal that Aterian has secured. Right, and the fact that Aterian has secured it and that Rio Tinto has come to the country just for these licenses, it speaks volumes to me.
I mean, when you have a joint venture with the second largest mining company in the world...
Well, what more is there to say?
Yeah, what more does it say? Market cap circa £8 million. Well, you know, in a normal bull market, if there was such a thing happening right now, where would you put the market cap? Because I'd expect it to be many multiples of where it was now.
This is a sort of, I think with a company like BSF, where they've got that proprietary patented product, you can quite happily say it'd be higher. With Aterian, when it's exploratory, it's very difficult to know where the market cap would be in a bull market. I mean, we a company that I've covered pretty much in depth, if you don't, Power Metal Resources, their market cap is kind of in the doldrums, but their balance sheet and the projects that they have on hand, you'd think it should be much, much higher when the bull market returns. With Aterian, I can say is I think that when the market returns, it will be much higher. I wouldn't be happy putting a figure on it. I think it's difficult to put a figure on exploratory.
If you got the information that in a year's time, okay, they were producing from the trading arm £2 million of EBITDA, okay, per annum. So it would take them till the end of next year to get to that point. But then 2025, they're going to have $2 million of EBITDA coming in from the trading. So if you have a company with that in its equation, and you have Morocco assets and you have the assets in Rwanda, granted exploratory assets, but you're going to have one asset that's going to have $7.5 million spent on it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it's necessarily worth more, but it probably is. What sort of valuation can we surmise if those things were in place?
You maybe get to say a $25 million valuation if you're doing well, if the market's turned. I think the trading arm is what underpins it all, because at the moment, the problem you have with many junior resource companies is people are worried there's going to be a placing to fund, you know, whatever activities, because that's the way it's done, which is fair enough. So the share price falls, and then you have a placing, and then the share price falls further and goes on and so forth. But the moment you have a trading arm where you're making, say, £2 million a year, and you've got enough revenue to fund those ongoing activities without needing to place shares, that's the point at which you'll have a lot of investors jump in because they're comfortable being in the company longer term. So yeah, I think you could probably get it to 25 million. But then this is the thing with these kind of moonshot companies, where when you look at like those lithium asset and that Rio Tinto joint venture, it's either going to come up with something exceptional or it's not. I think we can probably agree on that. And I think given the assets that they have and the joint venture they've got together, they'll probably come up with something really, really good. But again, this is, you know, an early stage growth company. And while it's a really, really good opportunity, it's something where if you like lithium, you might want to go, okay, so I'm going to get some shares in Pilbara Minerals, for example, in the ASX. Yeah. I'm going to get some shares in Albemarle. And then Aterian's going to form a smaller part of the portfolio. It definitely should be included.
Okay. Let's move on to the next one. Something slightly different. It's in the biotech space. We've got Sizzle Biotech. So we've spoken to Alan Sims before on the podcast. It's just stock we like as well. Obviously, this is a flagship asset. Is a blood test for the early detection of lung cancer, partnered with a $9.7 billion biotechny to explore its asset base. The opportunity as a growth share is simply immense. So what are your thoughts on that, and what are the risks associated with this company?
Well, the share price hasn't done particularly well, but I think with biotech companies, if you're a long-term investor, you're there for generally for a buyout at a huge premium. So I think the risk at the moment are relatively low. I mean, if you look at current CT scans for lung cancer, the false positivity rate is around 90%. So they're effectively useless. So you have to have like a medical investigation, and that's both very expensive and also occasionally quite dangerous when you're kind of, because if you're opening up a person and they've got lung cancer, you're trying to find it in their lungs. You can imagine that's not particularly easy to do. So there's no NHS approved biomarker blood based diagnostic test for early stage lung cancer. It doesn't exist. But Sizzle believes that it has found the answer to this problem. So if you're a patient, there's no radiation, it's significantly faster, it's not invasive at all, it's just a blood test. And the other thing, what's really important, I think potentially not underscored, is that it's a one-off test. So if you don't have the Sizzle test, you have to go back to hospital again and again and again and again. It's expensive and also time-consuming. With this test, just a one-off blood test, and then you're good to go. Now, the having partners with Biotechny, which is a 9.7, like I say, nearly $10 billion company, the investment case for me is really simple, which is that at some point Biotechny will go, this test that you've developed is really good, we're just going to buy it from you.
Yeah.
You know, it's as simple as that.
Yeah, and they've had some good research agreements with, I believe, the University of York as well, which were...
Which
look really good. And obviously, I remember talking to Alan, and he was saying that they got an investment in Conduit, who are seeking a listing on the NASDAQ, and I think they've got a 5% share of that company. So should that list in the NASDAQ, then they've got the option to potentially sell down those and make a few million pounds from those, from that stock.
Yeah, let's move on.
Yeah, so obviously Conroy Gold, as we alluded to, we were in Dublin a couple of weeks ago and we visited three of the mine sites. We visited the Clontibret, where they've got half a million ounces JORC on that asset there. We also visited Clay Lake, which is in just sort of goes into Northern Ireland, so across over the border. And then we also visit Creamkill, where they've seen this visible gold. I think they got some 123 grams per ton rock out there, out the ground. So that one looked very promising. So obviously, as you've written in your report, joint venture agreement with Dimir Export, with 6,000 meters of drilling completed in phase one and new gold in bedrock discovery confirmed by that drilling. Multiple mines targeted and a gold district stretching some 65 kilometers. Market cap has risen a little bit since your 7 million, probably around the sort of 7.5-8 million, had a good rise from the 11 pence to the 16 pence zone recently. Market is still very much asleep on it with the JV. What do you think it's missing there at the moment, Charles, the market?
I think it's not really missing so much as there's a fear factor there, and then there's a portfolio factor. So the fear factor is Scott Gold, which you'll know. I had shares in Scott Gold. It wasn't a major position, but Scott Gold essentially said their gold assets in Scotland was going to make everybody very wealthy. And then the company didn't make that happen, right? In fact, it collapsed. So you have the situation where, unfortunately, Conroy is just across the sea. And yeah, by association, I think some investors are just worried that, you know, it will just be exactly the same story. I don't think it will be, by any means.
Do you think it's a case of nobody believes, or maybe people can't get their head around the fact that there is that much gold in Ireland and so close to our shores? I mean,
we've seen the
Welsh gold at Clogau with Alba and people paying a premium for it. But do you think the market's a little bit sceptical about the fact that it could be in Ireland?
Yeah, I think so. I obviously people forget we have a really rich and varied mining heritage in this country that we've kind of forgotten about. But I think people probably think the gold probably isn't there. And there's also the fact that Conroy, as I wouldn't describe it as jammed tomorrow, because I don't think that's the position they've taken. But it has been the case, investors have gone, this year will be our year, this year will be our year. I think 2024 will be, the year that it's going to see a sizable gap. I'm glad to see it's already started rising. But that, I think it is fair to say that a lot of people thought 2023 would be a great year for Conroy as well. Yeah. So I think the wider, where I was alluding to, like, the portfolio issue, this is not Conroy Gold's assets. This is Conroy within, the wider small cap gold space. Yes, it's got it.
Do you think Dimir Export, obviously being pretty much a privately owned company from the Kirsch family, who are obviously one of the wealthiest families certainly in Turkey and probably within the world itself, if you look at their net worth, do you think that name is not big enough, or people go, oh, I've never heard of Dimir?
They just don't know it. It's as simple as that. I mean, once you explain it a little bit, like who they are and what they do, then yes, they do. But like Greatland Gold, for example, okay? Everyone, anyone who's listening to this will probably know who and what Greatland Gold are. Now, Wiley Metals, Andrew Forrester, you'll know who that is, right? But there was a time in the not too distant past where a UK investor wouldn't know Wiley Metals is. Yeah. And so I think, to me, it's a similar sort of thing. Dimir is, again, a very kind of important name, but unless you understand the space and have like in-depth knowledge of it, it's not something you're going to know much about. It's one of the ones where the market's asleep. But again, this is why, for me, it's a growth stock, because it's got the assets, it's got Dimir, it's completed some drilling, it's doing more drilling, the gold is there. And it will, in my view, it will come good over the longer term.
So put this asset into Paterson region of Australia, 500,000 ounces. What are we talking valuation?
I mean, significantly higher than. And then Paterson, I think, to be fair, I mean, Paterson is just, it's probably the best mining region in the world. I think, we're being honest. So, that would be a ridiculous valuation. But then you've got to bear in mind, Paterson, you've got a really, really supported political system. You've got masses and masses of really highly skilled engineers. You've got the infrastructure and the ports and the rail and the road and everything else and the electricity and the power. And, Conroy's assets don't have all of that infrastructure right next to it. Sure. So I am saying that's a drawback. If you're going to develop that asset, you've got to think, okay, so how are we actually going to get this from? We've got this amazing deposit of gold in the ground. How are we going to get it out profitably? And for example, if you look at like the Paterson region, all the sustaining costs will be relatively low because you've got all of that infrastructure. When you're looking at Conroy, the initial capital expenditure will probably be higher. And therefore, you've got, you know, as an investor, okay, well, that market cap is relatively, well, is very low for what they have. I can go in. When this market cap is, say, doubled or trebled, it'll be harder to justify it unless they've got that sort of long-term plan. So what I'd like to see from them is going, okay, so what's the plan to actually get it from drilling to out of the ground? Are investors going to get diluted? Probably not, because dilution at this level won't give you enough money to, you know, get it won't even give you enough cash to get what needs to happen.
You think their reports are a little bit, not say lacking, but I saw Paul Johnson comment on X the other day, you know, about saying basically like, come on, Conroy, can you provide us with a nice map showing where all the holes have been sunk to date with the assays and, you know, just give us a bit more of a roadmap as to what they need.
Yeah, well, this is exactly, I'm kind of in agreement with him. This is what I'm saying. It needs somebody to spend a month, right, in an office, just shut them in a lot with a tool. Like, this is what you need to do. You need to create a new corporate presentation, essentially. Here's a PowerPoint with everything we've done so far. And I said, I would suspect that somebody is doing that now. And I don't know the company, I don't know the guys over there, but you would imagine, having done, you know, the phase one drilling, that somebody's doing that right now. Would you? Yeah, they must be. Somebody must be, because they want to.
We hope so. We certainly told them when we were in Ireland that they need to up their game in terms of a few things. And I'm in conversation with Maureen and Cahill as well in terms of what they're going to be putting out. So let's hope so. Let's hope so. Yeah. Because it's not even under the radar. It's not on the radar as far as I can see. And, you know, the gold is there. It's in what quantity? We already have a JORC, $500,000. The $500,000 JORC is probably not even valued in the current market cap of £8 million ultimately. So I keep saying it doesn't make a lot of sense, but this market's bananas at the minute. So
I won't list them now, but if you feel like it, go through, do some fundamental analysis. There are plenty of AIM companies with more cash on the books than their market capitalizations at the moment. They're out there.
Yeah.
There are companies that have more cash in the bank account than the market values them at. It's just madness. This market is insane. I'm sure you guys could probably name some if you wanted to now, but probably best not, because who might start a stampede? Moving on, but I think the next one was Golden Metal Resources, which, you know, this is one of my favorite ones, has been for a while. So he's got the largest tungsten, undeveloped tungsten deposit in the United States. And the key thing for me here is the political situation. So to China's banned lots of exports of specific rare earth minerals, banned the export of some graphite. And I think there's almost certainly going to be a tungsten export ban. This could be a problem for the US because it gets a decent chunk. In fact, most of its tungsten comes from China. But even so, the US Department of Defense is banning the import of tungsten from China from 2026. Now, China could impose a new export ban sooner. And the basic argument is that the US is going to provide some sort of non-dilutive grant funding to Golden Metal Resources to develop their tungsten deposit, Pilot Mountain. Now, Oliver Friesen, the CEO, has been kind of pursuing this for a few months now, at least a few months, in fact, possibly longer. And I think it's pretty much, I wouldn't say guaranteed, because you can't guarantee anything ever, but I think the political situation just means that this deposit will get developed because it's in the strategic interests of the United States to make it happen. So I'm not sure what the market cap is currently, but the market cap was just 6.7 million. As a growth share, I think that's a great opportunity. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think it's more than a one-trick pony, but the pony you've talked about is probably the one everybody's talking about. I think the Carlin style gold that they also have in Nevada is and could be monstrous in size. They've managed to peg out copper as well,
and the copper.
In the claims for basically next to nothing. So
and Kibbe and Kibbe lithium as well.
Yeah, Kibbe.
And the lithium as well. I mean, if you wanted to have sort of battery metals, and then you've got something that is to do with defense as well as a play. This Golden Metal Resources at, as you say, 6.65 million market cap has got to be on the list, doesn't it? You know, at the very least.
Yeah.
Nevada has to be one of the nicest places to mine in terms of jurisdictions. I don't mean the place itself. I mean, you know, how friendly they are in terms of what they want to do. You can get licenses. And as you said, the US government needs tungsten. The defense sector desperately needs the tungsten.
Yeah.
And if the Chinese say no more tungsten, guys, then they're going to have to get this in production inside probably a couple of years if they can.
They have, you know, one of the things about it with the US, again, I covered this kind of in depth a few weeks ago. They've been selling off their tungsten deposits for years and years. So they built up like a huge deposit of tungsten because you essentially need it specific military applications, right? Including in weapons. And so during and after the Cold War, they built up this massive deposit of tungsten as national strategic reserves. And then they decided to sell it off rather than, you know, because it's easier to sell off an asset for money than in post-taxes. And now they're in this position where the world has become a more dangerous place, whether it's the Middle East or Russia, Ukraine, or China, Taiwan. They need to get that tungsten, they need to get their domestic supply of tungsten back online. And Golden Metal Resources, for that market cap with Pilot Mountain, I'm astounded the market cap is as low as it is. But again, these markets make no sense anymore.
So's Oliver.
Yeah, I'm sure Oliver is, you know. I think
I'm supposed to be meeting Oliver next week for a pint in London because I'm coming over to London for a couple of days. So he just cannot believe that it's as. I think I got a message from him one day because he wanted to buy on the market and then they wouldn't let him because there was no news coming out.
It would surprise me.
And he was like,
I don't know what it is. This is one of those things. So right, I think you could argue it's opportunity cost. Right, it is part of what it is. So say you're an investor and you've got £5,000 to invest, right? And you're looking at Golden Metal Resources. And yes, you've got the copper assets are nice and Kibby Lithium is nice. And you know, you've got a decent asset base. But what you're looking for in the story is that catalyst. And the catalyst is going to be, okay, they've got the offtake letter of agreement already. They need to get that grant funding from the US. When is it going to come? If you think it's going to come next week, you're going to buy shares now. If you think it's going to come in 3 months' time, you're going to wait 3 months. So again, I think it's one of those where it's going to be people are waiting for a hint either from Oliver or from the US. You know, if you look at like Canada and they just approved their, you know, critical mineral strategy, and it's like $1.1 billion worth of investment is going into the sector. If the US put out a bulletin tomorrow saying we're going to develop all our tungsten deposits and we're going to make that happen, that's going to be what pushes it in. Or Oliver, you know, Oliver is finally able to release an RNS that says we've got £10 million worth of grant funding. If you look at Glencore Resources, hopefully you guys know they have £5 million of DFC granting from the US.
Yeah,
$5 million. I can imagine something like that happening in Golden Metal, maybe larger in the near future. And so for me, it's one of those companies where the market cap is just very, very low compared to what the assets they have. And then again, for me, top growth stock.
Okay, the next one on the list, and this is an interesting one, is Shuka Minerals. Now, we've actually had the CEO on the podcast before, Noel Leons, who obviously they had a name change. They were originally Edenville. I think EDL was the ticker, and they've now went through the board change, and obviously a new chairman was appointed, and they also appointed a non-executive director in Quinton van der Burgh. We know, we've talked before about Jason Brewer as well. Obviously, he's executive director at the company. So it looks like, that, you know, with this board restructure, I mean, their asset they've got the Rukwa coal asset in Tanzania is absolutely massive, isn't it? It's gigantic.
It's huge. I mean, like I did earlier in the year when it looked like Jason was going and Quinton were going to come on board, I looked at it and I just thought, this asset should be running very profitably. It's just not being run properly. Now, what's interesting is that given the name change for strategic direction, it looks like they want to go in kind of the critical minerals route and away from the coal. But I look at Rukwa and I just go, this is an asset where prior management has just failed to develop it properly. It really is as simple as that. And I just say, okay, market cap 6.4 million. If you get the coal exporting properly, then you're going to see that market cap rise really, really quickly, really, really fast. And I think for me, it's just when I know Jason Brewer can be a divisive figure among investors, but Marula, I mean, I highlighted that at 2.45p and that went all the way up to the 15, 16p. I think he's riding around 12p at the moment. So in the space of a year, when they took on Edenville, I think that's risen sharply from when they came on board. So I look at it and I go, well, if he could do it with Marula, he'll probably do it with Shuka as well.
Do you think Jason Brewer is the ultimate PR machine for a company?
I think this is really interesting. I'm doing a for somebody. I'm talking about the activist investor, which is what I would describe Jason as. Oliver at Golden Metal, completely different personality in many ways, but again, activist investor. This is somebody you're going to find on Telegram groups, tweet on Twitter a lot, doing tons of PR. And what's really interesting about it is, if that activist CEO were to leave the company, what would that do to their asset base? How valuable is that CEO? What do they bring to the table? When I look at Jason, I see someone who's extremely hardworking, but also I think sometimes the assets that they have on the books, what he is able to do is he's able to market them in a way that a retail investor understands. So even if you have an asset that's, you know, kind of average, he can go, this is why it's good. This is the country where it's at. This is how we're going to develop it. That's a skill that many CEOs just don't have.
And I think that probably stems from the fact that he's been a private investor, a retail investor in many companies over the years, right?
That's fine. I've been writing freelance since 2016, 2017, right? So we're coming up to sort of 8 years now-ish. And it's only in the past year or so that I've started to put my name on Twitter and LinkedIn and, you know, build like a social profile, purely because, I think AI is going to take a lot of the more serious blue chip content writing that I do. So I do a lot of work for IG Index, for example, or various blue chip. I'm under NDA, so I can't really say. AI, you know, like ChatGPT and Bard and things like that, are going to take a lot of that work from me. So I need to have my name out there. And what I try to do is I try to take complex retail investment cases and distill them down so that the retail investor can understand. I mean, Greatland Gold, you know, we chatted about it a second ago. I did a really long form piece of a few thousand words just over a month ago, just explaining everything to new investors. And for a lot of people who didn't get, you know, why it was such a good opportunity at 6p, it kind of clicked. And, you know, that share price kind of almost doubled in the past month or so. Now, when I look at like Jason, there's plenty of things we don't have in common, but one of the things I think we do have in common is that we're able to explain why an asset is, you know, better than other assets, or why it's more marketable, or to a retail investor, I can convince somebody, you know, this is a good asset to buy in to. And I don't need to talk about mineral resource estimates or you know, cost of drilling or any of that. It's just distilling it down. I think this is one of the key problems that you have with a lot of CEOs in the space, is that because they have such a broad depth of knowledge, they assume everybody else does. And so you have this kind of situation where you go, okay, so we're going to talk about all the sustaining costs, and we're going to talk about the region that we're in, and we're going to talk about all of our drilling activity, and we're going to say, you know, X, Y, Z at YPD, and you've already lost the retail investor base because they don't understand it. So, you know, that's what I think. You know, I look at Shuka and I think, okay, well, it's got Rukwa. It should operate profitably. It could grow quite fast.
Yeah, I guess it is a case of, like, let's see if this board change and the shakeup can actually, pardon the pun, Shuka Shaker, can actually, you know, make Rukwa a profitable business, because it's
I mean, you don't know. This is the thing. You don't know. It's a growth stock. But I think that at the very least, they'll be able to sell it at a reasonable, you know, valuation, and then go into something else.
The only connection we had with Jason Prior, is it? Was with the gold mine in Kenya, was it? What was the name of that company?
Caracol Gold, yeah.
Which has had sort of imploded since he left.
Well, I mean, you had, if I remember correctly, you had the Osen funding in late 2022. It was $10 million off the top of my head. And then Osen pulled out because there was some kind of regulatory issue. And then since then, yeah, they've had problems, and I think that's just a lack of due diligence. But again, I think that was after, as far as I'm aware, that was after Jason's time. But, you know, again, as I said at the start, he is a divisive figure. Some investors love him, some investors hate him. All I know is that the investments where Marula, where I was an early investor, has done well. Whether it will continue to do well or not, you know, we don't know. It's a growth stock. Shuka has got Rukwa. It should operate profitably. And again, I think it will operate profitably. It just needed that management change. I think it should be fine. But again, it's another one of those companies. It's not one where I would say, go all in, put your entire pension money on it. It's one of the ones where buy some shares, wait a year, see what happens. And then finally, we have Acuity RM, which is a stream risk management platform, which I find really interesting, because they've got public sector contracts, so government, utilities, defense, broadcasting, manufacturing, healthcare. Market cap's only £5.3 million. And when I look at Acuity, I just look at that and go, this is a company that can probably scale relatively cheaply. I say scaling will be expensive, but everything's relative. And they'll continue to get more government contracts as they prove the platform. Simple as that. Have you guys come across Acuity before?
Yeah, we represent Acuity.
Oh, you do? Wonderful.
Yeah, and we agree with your sentiment. I think it went up to sort of 9-10p, I think, and has come right back down to the low, sort of mid to low fours in terms of its valuation. I think going ahead, if you look at the valuation of it now and in 12 months, I think there will be a major, major move. And simply because they will get more contracts, I think. We haven't really had any major contracts from the US yet those deals have been struck 6 to 9 months ago. There's no doubt that the government contracts are going to grow, because as one government department uses it, it's going to filter into other government departments. Then going to be sort of a snake that roams around all of the different government contracts or government departments, something that's in them all, I think, in the end. And that's going to mean millions. So I think you're talking maybe the end of the next year, you might be talking anything. I know it's a big discrepancy, but anywhere from maybe 3.5 to 5.5 million of recurring revenue is what I think may happen by the end of next year. And you can't have a market cap £5.5 million with that much revenue. So I know sort of Angus's stated aim is to have sort of a somewhere in the region of 60p share price, and then maybe they'll be the size to be gobbled up by one of the big software houses. So I think that's probably a likely plan. So from a market at 4.5p at the minute, that could be a good investment. Whether it take 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, I don't know, but I don't think it's going to take any longer than that.
Well, this is public sector. This is the key thing. It's a public sector contract. Like you say, they grow because once one department is using it, the next one will. But the other thing is, it's always recurring revenue. So once you've got that contract, with that government department, as long as the system works, and it seems clear that it does, you've then got that for the next 1,000 years.
Yeah, it's 96%, I think it is, that they get renewals.
Yeah, exactly. So it's essentially, to all intents and purposes, it's essentially that revenue, you're going to get that every single year. 5 million our market cap, yeah. I mean, it's just ridiculously low for what it is. But having said, I will qualify this. I'm not an IT technician. The Stream Risk Management platform is wildly beyond my IT ability.
Yeah.
But the contracts that it has and what it's managed to do so far speaks to me that it's just wildly undervalued.
Yeah, I think we're talking at the minute, I think they're closing in on £2 million of recurring revenue.
Yeah,
at the minute.
So £2 million, so, and I mean, then the profit margins are really high as well, as far as I'm aware. Yeah. So you've got a business with £2 million recurring revenue already, 80% profit margins. You're in the public sector. These things are all, green flags. And this is one of the things I really like about it. I can't see any red flags with the company. When you're talking about the other tech companies, sometimes you look at it and go, okay, well, these are the problems that it's going to run into. Acuity, I don't see any glaring issues. But do you? I haven't seen anything where.
No, they've obviously done their own risk management, he says, with a
ironic. Yeah,
so no, I don't really see it. The only issue is, they've got to reach economies of scale, because the reality is, at the minute, it's not profitable at £2 million, quite obviously.
No.
But at £10 million, it's mega profitable. It's maybe 60% of that £10 million is profit then, So
the only real negatives we've seen on the groups are people whinging about them putting out RNSs for 75,000, 85,000 contracts and things like that, which I think it's a you've got to put news out, right? And it is.
Yeah, you do.
So I can't, understand why people attack that. But ultimately, yeah, Kev's right. It needs to be scaled up now.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking earlier about having an active CEO, not physically active, but, putting that RNS. So putting out an RNS is not free. It does often, it costs a few hundred, if not a couple grand sometimes, depending on the complexity. But you have to put those RNSs out because you have to sell something to the market. You have to say, yes, the company's still growing. We're still getting contracts. And when you get sort of a 75 or 100 grand contract, you might not think that's much, but it's bread and butter. It's money coming into the company. it's something, you know, to do. And I think on top of that, the other thing that investors occasionally don't get is that, okay, so this contract might be worth 75 grand now, it could be worth a lot more in the future. You've got a client who's saying, well, this company's only got a £5 million market cap, we want to try it out, we don't want to go all in, and then if it works, it might become much, much bigger. And then on top of that, you have software is never perfect initially. In theory, it always is. You put it out in practice and there's bugs, right? You have those smaller scale contracts of like 75 or 100 grand. And then rather than, say, Acuity announces, you know, a £10 million contract tomorrow, they're not going to, it's unlikely, but say they were, and then there was a problem, it would be a huge deal. When you've got a 100 grand contract and there's a problem, you work out the bug. And then when those bigger contracts come along, there'll be no issues at all. So it's one of those things where investors just want a massive return on their money straight away. It's going to scale over time. Simple as that.
Now, I think one of the things with Acuity that is unfortunate in some ways is that they are under NDA with the names and people of the clients. So I think if some of those names were banded about, I think people would have a very different view of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Palantir at a much, much higher level. It's very tricky when you can't, or even myself, the freelancer, I work with some really big blue chip names, but NDAs, there's so many in the industry that it's virtually impossible to talk about the work you do sometimes. But again...
And another company that's under that is actually BSFA.
Yeah, so indeed.
Their leather stuff is all under NDA. Now they've said it's a French house or whatever, but you know,
I mean, we can figure out, we can't say it, but we could probably figure out who it is they're working with. This is the problem with small cap companies in the growth area. Often they're under NDA and they can't say what clients they're working with, and if they did, the share price would go crazy. I remember, do you Turn? And that, you know, they're one of their portfolio companies were linked with Starlink, and you know, the share price went absolutely ballistic, and then, you know, it calmed down pretty quickly afterwards. But often it's the case that all you need is to say, oh, we're linked to this company, and then, you know, and then suddenly people realize the implications of what you have. I think, you know, that's another company, a growth company, is Tech Capital and Microsalt, which are their portfolio company, which is a salt with 50% less sodium than table salt. Eventually that company will, you know, when it IPOs, will do very, very well. But in the small cap space, it's very tricky because a lot of the time you can't even talk about who you're partnering with. If you look at the next company we're going to talk about, which is Tertiary Minerals. So their local partner has managed to get into a non-binding earning and joint venture to explore one of their assets, Concola West, with a third party. And all they've been able to describe it as is a well-resourced mineral exploration and mining company. $6 million contract, but they can't even say who they're drilling with.
No,
you know. So
yeah, it's and we know this. We know this one relatively well. We went to Zambia in the early part of the year to visit a few other assets from companies like you know, within Galileo and African Pioneer. And basically, this is actually one of their projects. I think it's the Mukai project. It's adjacent to the large Sentinel mine, which is one of it's like the eighth or ninth biggest copper mine in the world. And we really we realize now, after having been, that just how much copper there is in the ground, and it's pretty much one of the biggest resources of copper in the world.
Well, it is. Yeah, I mean, you needed, the issue that they had up until a couple of years ago is that the political environment was, we don't want foreign investment, and that's completely turned its head now. Now they want as much investment as possible. They want to get all the copper out of the ground. And the Mukai project is adjacent to Sentinel, but it's also adjacent to ARC Minerals' claim. So ARC Minerals obviously has just signed this awesome joint venture with it's Anglo American, isn't it?
Yeah.
And for, you know, for tens of millions of drilling. And so, I mean, for my money, the Mukai project is adjacent to Sentinel. It's adjacent to ARC Minerals' claims. I think at some point, you know, somebody, whether it's ARC Mineral or somebody else, will just go, look, we just want to buy this asset from you. And bear in mind, Tertiary Minerals, it's only got a £2.4 million market cap. So it doesn't need to be a particularly large offer to see a huge boost in the share price. I just say, for example, you're ARC Minerals and you've got this really great JV with Anglo-American, and you're finding loads and loads of copper. Hopefully, it's what they're going to do. It kind of makes sense to just buy this little project that's kind of right next door to you to do some further exploration if it all goes well. What do you guys think? Or do you,
I don't know. I think it's the same, and we've got the same situation in African Pioneer with the joint venture
First Quantum, isn't it? Yeah.
The First Quantum have got this with AFP, and it's in the same area as Tertiary Minerals. I mean, they're literally a few kilometers apart, I think.
Well, I think Mackay is there's technical cooperation. There's a data sharing agreement with First Quantum, between First Quantum and Tertiary Minerals.
There you go. So there's a good chance First Quantum could come in and take.
Zambia. I mean, one of the things in the junior resource sector that you guys will get, but listeners may not get, is that often you've got the same people exploring all the targets, just wearing a different branded T-shirt. So you're going, you're okay. This is Tertiary Minerals asset, and this is Arc Minerals asset, and this is First Quantum's asset, and this is Sentinel Mine and whatever else. But actually, someone going out and doing the exploring, there's only so many people who are capable of doing that. So, you know, I look at it and I just go, this is just an asset that's in the middle of all of this exploration. Somebody is just going to buy it
And the same ground as well, just so to add to your story, African Pioneer owns ground and it's with First Quantum. Galileo has ground adjacent, which isn't with First Quantum yet. And so does Basant. Okay, so there you go. You have three of Collins.
You've got the extract as well.
So all four of Colin Bird's companies so happen to have land in that is next to each other in this area. I wonder why.
I wonder why as well. Well, I do wonder why. I've even told the reason why. There's loads of copper and he wants to make loads of money. But I think it's funny, isn't it, how I'm surprised at Tertiary Minerals got this project. That's what surprises me. It's a microcap company. It's very small. I don't know how it got it, but I do look at it. I just go, okay, so it might go nowhere. But as Zambia continues to drive through its copper development, somebody is going to look at that project and go, we're going to throw a bit of money at it and just buy it out.
Yeah, no, and I agree with it 100%. I think Tertiary Minerals is a very good bet. The only thing is, does Tertiary Minerals have other assets, or it's basically this?
There's Conchola West with the JV, there's Mackay, and then there's three other assets as well. I think they're all spread out through Zambia. But it's one of those. I mean, if you're looking at a company with a £2 million market cap, you're essentially going, you know, you're putting the investment in, you're either going to lose it all or you're going to do very, very well. Nothing in the middle.
And I think the thing that's why, and I'm pushing my boat, African Pioneer appeals to me, because it has the asset in Namibia, which has mining license for copper, and it's almost ready to go in terms of starting to put the things together to actually create a mine. So
But then, I mean, having said that, I mean, they've African Pioneers 4.5 million-ish market cap.
Yeah.
So yes, they've got more diversification, but then you have to pay for it. And I'm not saying that's a bad or a good thing necessarily. It's just the case that if you want to go for that sort of hyper risky, hyper growth asset, I guess let's add African Pioneer to the list because it's got a similar kind of investment case, but maybe just slightly more diversified.
I think it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that both of them could be worth, you know, literally nine figures. They both could be worth £100 million, in my view.
Okay, so here's a question for you then. So
no, it's a big thing to say.
Yeah, sorry.
It's not beyond the bounds of possibility in my view, because if the copper's there, if the Kawisi style copper is there in those licenses, then it's worth a hell of a lot of money. Yeah.
So even in the ground. For you both then a question. So if one of these companies we've talked about or other company in the junior space that's got a maybe a joint venture is snapped up for, I don't know, 10x on the current price or 15, 20x, what will that do to the market at that point in terms of, the, will it change everybody's view on these juniors? Will we have a liquidity event? What do you see happening if we see one or two of these companies getting snapped up?
I think one won't be enough. One, people will just go, well, this is just, you know, this company was just lucky and they found something amazing. Two, and the market will start to wake up. Three companies, and then you'll light the fire. I think we can all pretty much agree we're at the bottom of the market or close to. And so to get those kind of those valuations sparking back up again, you need to have a position where investor greed has to be higher than investor fear.
And
Sorry?
FOMO, fear of missing out.
Fear of missing out. Fear of, oh, sorry. FOMO, FOMO. But this is the thing. You need to be more scared that you're going to lose out on a 10-bagger, right, than you are of being diluted. It's as simple as that. And at the moment, because you have this fear of being diluted more than you have, you know, the hope that you're going to land something big. And the problem is that these are risk assets. So when you're investing in any of those eight companies, you know, or the others we've talked about, you're assuming that one or two, you know, that some of them aren't going to work out. I think you need to just have that assumption. You're going to have a drilling campaign at one of these companies and it doesn't turn up anything or whatever, right? But the generic idea is that you're going to come out on top. And I think you do. You just need to have a couple of big market buyouts at massive premiums to get everybody back into the market.
Yeah, and I don't think the premiums need to be 10 bucks either. I think a premium of 2, 3, 4, everyone start getting excited if there's a few of them, as you said.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing, though, when we picked our 12 stocks last year, because we do this 12 stocks for Christmas scenario, and we will do it again this year, is that I think that three of the worst performing stocks we had were the three, in my view, safe bets that we put in there, that were producing assets that we really thought they were going to do well. There was Jubilee Metals, there was Ben's Creek, and I forget what the other one was, but they were...
And yeah, ironically, you say they're the ones that are actually generating revenues and EBITDA positive. You know, they're a producing company.
I think the problem that you have, okay, so if you're an investor and you have my kind of strategy, and I think it's relatively common, you buy a bit of gold, you invest in an S&P 500 tracker, or it doesn't really, just blue chips in general. I know we have disagreements on the US, but you've put a decent chunk of your money into blue chips. When you're coming to the AIM market, you're coming for risk assets where you're going to get, you know, potentially very high returns in a relatively short space of time. So when you've got a company that's, we're producing and we're profitable and we're positive a bit, I mean, the problem that you have is that, yes, those are all positive things, but the investors aren't going to get, if investors wanted that, they go to the blue chips for that. And this this is the trouble that you have. So you have the situation where companies that are producing and running a solid business model are now undervalued because investors, you know, will go to the blue chips for that. The people want.
I get your argument. The other one that I missed out was Prospect Energy. So Prospect Energy, Jubilee and Ben's Creek are all down around the 50% mark this year. They're all producing.
Yeah. If it helps Prospect Energy, I was exactly the same. I was very bullish on that company. And yeah, down 50%. So, you know, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that, you know, it did exactly what it said it was going to do on the 10th as well. Nothing particularly went horrendously wrong. The share price has gone down.
A bit longer than it was anticipating, but we're already talking about 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, which is nothing. I mean, if you, it's nothing. In this, you know, in the resource space, I've always said you should attach just whatever an RNS says, just assume a 6 month delay and just be surprised if they do it on time. I don't think anyone's ever managed to do anything exactly on time, because there always comes up with hiccups and pitfalls and problems, and there's always a technical issue or something or other. Or it's particularly if you're operating in Africa or parts of South America, there'll be some kind of governmental problem. I think, you know, when I those stocks that we've talked about this afternoon, I wouldn't say they're, you know, the best stocks to invest in. What they are is really, really, really good opportunities for your risk investing, for where you've done your investing in blue chips and now you've got a bit of risk money and you want to see a huge return. And I think they could, all of them could do really, really well.
Yeah,
indeed. And there are many more, and maybe we'll talk about some of those as we go along.
Yeah, I ask for submissions because I'm aware that, you know, people will have other opinions, and, you know, I'm certain that there's more. You can probably name about 1,000 more.
1,000 more, but I think there is a good solid. I think you could make a list of 20 at least that would be a good solid. What we consider in this risk criteria, as you say, as good solid opportunities to make significantly more than you could lose, if you know what I mean. And I think that's the risk criteria, isn't it? You're balancing your risk. If you're happy to accept that you could lose 50, 60, 70% of your money if you need the money in a year's time, on the upside, that you could actually make 3 or 4 times your money or 5 times your money.
Yeah, well, I mean, this, I was talking to, we were talking at the very beginning about the budget, and, you know, the median salary is 35,000 a year, you know, compared to the US, for example, in Australia is very low, but it is what it is in the UK. So if you've got, say, 4,000, 5,000 a year to invest, and you're the average retail investor listening to this, you put it into an index fund, and in 7 years' time, you'll probably double your money. Unless something goes very wrong, you'll likely double your money, right? If you just in relatively low risk assets. But if you put £5,000 into the AIM market, you'll either that'll either drop to 1,000 or you'll make 50,000. And so you have to, you know, what difference can that make to your life? I guess is my question. Personally, I would always say you need to have some money going to risk assets. Because otherwise, you know, you're not going to make a huge difference to your life just investing in blue chips. You have to do a bit of diversification.
And we
all, investment advice.
Yeah. We all want the 50 grand, obviously.
Yeah.
It's obviously whether you're willing to take the risk and not bitch about it afterwards if it doesn't work out for you.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if you, I called the lithium boom back in 2017. And I said, you know, a lot of these small cap lithium companies, particularly in Australia, so like Pilbara Minerals, for example, are going to do really, really, really well. And obviously they did. They did really, really well in the period in 2021, 2022, where, you know, they reached all-time highs and everyone made loads of money. But I think we were talking about this before, you know, just before we got on the podcast, you have this situation where not only do you have to have, you know, the attitude of this is my risk money, but also you need to be able to hold through the volatility. And so regardless of, you know, if you decide, right, I'm going to buy shares in Ethereum and then the share price starts to dip a little bit, you can't buy in and buy out and, you know, trade over the short term. You have to go, right, I'm in with my money and it's either going to generate a huge return or it's not. And if you want to go down the trading route on AIM, God help you, because I don't know anyone who manages to actually do it successfully and posts everything that they trade. So,
yeah, good. All right. Well, I think we've talked for long enough there. There's probably about 70, 80 minutes of material. So
just
on that note, say, you know, thanks very much for listening. And if you like what you've heard, please hit the subscribe and also the bell icon for future notifications. We'll say Charles Archer, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, of course. It's always nice to chat to you guys. I think we agree. We agree on most things, but we disagree on some stuff. And that's always what makes the most interesting conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, we all agree we want to make money. It's where we're going to put it to make the money.
Yes, indeed. That's the name of the game.
Let's be honest. And we all agree that we'll probably lose money on some of the stuff as well. So,
I don't know.
You know, this is part of the game, isn't it? And it is a game. So you should not be putting all of your assets into this basket, that's for sure.
No, you shouldn't.
At the same time, you want to decide how much of your assets you should be doing in this type of thing, because it can seriously turbocharge your portfolio if you get a couple of winners.
And you only need a couple. You really do.
Yeah.
Good.
Lovely to chat.
Speak next week.
Indeed.
Cheers.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.